26th of January, 2017, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 28, Kapila's Instructions on Devotional Service, Text 9. Pranasya Sorayan Margam Urakum Bhakare Chakai Pratikune Vachitam Nathasira Machanchalam. Pranasya,
a
vital air. Shortayat,
once
you clear.
Margam,
passage.
Pura
Kumbhaka Rechakai. By inhaling, retaining, and exhaling. Pratikulina, by reversing.
Or
Chitam,
the mind.
Yatam,
so that.
Spira, steady.
Achanchalam,
free from disturbances. Translation for Purvashi. The yogi should clear the passage of vital air by breathing in the following manner. First, he should inhale very deeply, then hold the breath in, and finally exhale. Or, reversing the process, the yogi can first exhale, then hold the breath outside, and finally inhale. This is done so that the mind may become steady and free from external disturbances. So this is a very simple pranayama that basically is a pause between the inhaling and the exhaling. So either you inhale, pause, and then exhale, or you exhale, pause, and then inhale. As some of you may know, there's very complicated pranayama procedures. There's many different complicated pranayama procedures. It's an extremely simple purport. These breathing exercises are performed to control the mind and fix it on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Savayamana Krishna Padaravindho. The devotee Amrish Maharaj fixed his mind on the lotus feet of Krishna 24 hours a day. The process of Krishna consciousness is to chant Hare Krishna and to hear the sound attentively so that the mind is fixed upon the transcendental vibration of Krishna's name, which is non-different from Krishna, the Personality. The real purpose of controlling the mind by the prescribed method of clearing the passage of the life air is achieved immediately if one fixes his mind directly on the lotus feet of Krishna. The Hatha Yoga system, or breathing system, is especially recommended for those who are very absorbed in the concept of bodily existence. But one who can perform the simple process of chanting Hare Krishna can fix the mind more easily. Three different activities are recommended for clearing the passage of breath: Purukha, Kumbhaka, and Rechaka. Inhaling the breath is called Purukha, sustaining it within is called Kumbhaka, and finally exhaling it is called Rechaka. These recommended processes can also be performed in the reverse mode. After exhaling, one can keep the air outside for some time and then inhale. The nerves through which inhalation and exhalation are conducted are technically called Ida and Pingala. The ultimate purpose of clearing the Ida and Pingala passages is to divert the mind from material enjoyment. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, one's mind is his enemy, and one's mind is also his friend. Its position varies according to the different dealings of the living entity. If we divert our mind to thoughts of material enjoyment, then our mind becomes an enemy. And if we concentrate our mind on the lotus feet of Krishna, then our mind is a friend. By the yoga system of Purukha, Kumbhaka, and Rechaka, or by directly fixing the mind on the sound vibration of Krishna or on the lotus, on the form of Krishna, the same purpose is achieved. In Bhagavad Gita 8.8, it is said that one must practice the breathing exercise of Vyasa Yogi Yuktena. By virtue of these processes of control, the mind cannot wander to external thoughts, Chaitasa Nandi Kamina. Thus, one can fix his mind constantly on the Supreme Personality of Godhead and can attain Yati. Practicing the yoga system, exercising breath control, is very difficult for a person in this age, and therefore Lord Chaitanya recommended Kirtaniya Sadahari. One should always chant the holy name of the Supreme Lord Krishna, because Krishna is the most suitable name of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The name Krishna and the Supreme Person Krishna are not different. Therefore, if one concentrates his mind on hearing and chanting Hare Krishna, the same result is achieved. Pranasya sohayan margam pura kumbhagare chikai pratikuyena vachitam yadastira machanchala. The yogi should clear the passage of vital air by breathing in the following manner. First, he should inhale very deeply, then hold the breath in, and finally exhale. Or reversing the process, the yogi can first exhale and hold the breath outside, and finally inhale. This is done so the mind may become steady and free from external disturbances. So, we have here chittam, itta, stiram, chanchalam. Chitta means what? What is chittam? Conscious one's awareness. Stiram, what is sta or stir? Steady. And chanchala means? Unsteady. Achanchala means? Steady, not moving. So stira achanchalam is basically two ways of saying the same thing. Be steady and don't move. So that the chittam in yata in this way. In this way, the chittam, the consciousness, becomes steady and doesn't move. So of course one of the main questions we get all the time in the Hare Krishna movement is how can I make my chittam stira achanchalam? This is one of the main questions is asked. Over and over and over and over and over and over again, like one of the top 5 or 10 questions that are asked in the Hare Krishna movement. How can I make my mind steady and not moving? Yes? Now, of course, it's interesting that when we ask this question, we may not understand why exactly we're asking this question. We may have been told by the scriptures, by Srila Prabhupada, by our acharyas, that we need to make the mind steady. We may not understand what the purpose of that is. And I think one of the reasons we have so much difficulty with this is that we may not really understand why we want to do this. And Prabhupada speaks in this purport about why we want to do it and how we can do it. And of course, two general methods are given here. One is by the process of pranayama, and one is by the process of chanting. Of course, these are not necessarily mutually exclusive processes. So why do we want to make the mind steady? We talked about this a little bit yesterday. And that the mind is a product of which mode? Goodness. The mind is a product of the mode of goodness. The intelligence is a product of the mode of compassion. The natural state of the mind is to be in goodness. And goodness is a very stable state of material nature. Passion is very active and moving. And ignorance moves only as little as possible, but not because of steadiness. Ignorance moves very little because of lethargy and
inertia.
Yeah. Not because of being fixed, but because of being dull. You understand? Just like when we're sleeping, we don't move around a lot. But that doesn't mean that it's any kind of elevated state. You understand? Or something just, you know, heavily intoxicated may just be sitting on the chair without moving. But that's more ignorance kind of non-moving. Better to move around in the mode of passion than to have lethargy in the mode of ignorance. But the mind's natural state is a steadiness in the mode of goodness, which is a state of balance and harmony. When the mind is naturally situated in its position of goodness, then it achieves a position of clarity. And if you think about the other questions that people ask in the Hare Krishna movement and outside the Hare Krishna movement, practically all of them could be solved if one achieved clarity. What do I do? How do I do it? You know, should I have this job or that job? Should I live in this place or that place? Should I marry or not? Should I marry this person? Should I have kids? How many? What career should I have? All the questions that people ask. Even what should I do for the next 5 minutes? How should I do it? How should I deal with this person? That's all a question of clarity. If we could see clearly, Krishna explains this very nicely in the Bhagavad Gita, that in the mode of ignorance, you don't know what's to be done, what's not to be done. You in fact, you go backwards. says, always striving in the wrong direction. You do the opposite of what you should do. And decisions made in the mode of ignorance achieve the opposite result. It may look like a good plan. We see this happens in modern Kali Yuga governments and planning commissions. They make a very good plan and it has the opposite result. So one example I like to give is that in America, they have all these laws to help disabled people, which that's a good thing, right? Should we help disabled people? Who's going to disagree with that? So they made a law that if doctors are going to be treating a deaf patient, they have to have a sign language interpreter. Sounds like a great idea, right? What they neglected to do was fund the program. So they mandated that the doctors had to have a sign language interpreter without providing government funds for them to do so. The doctors would have to pay for it out of pocket. Sign language interpreters are very expensive. And it's very easy to tell whether or not your prospective patient is deaf. That's not a difficult thing to tell. And so simply doctors stopped seeing deaf people. You know, they just said, sorry, I'm busy, you know, I don't have any appointments for the next 6 months, and so forth. And so the deaf patients went from getting a poor quality of service without an interpreter to getting no service at all. And this is the result of decisions made in the mode of ignorance. You know, you think, I'm going to help these disabled persons, and instead you end up hurting them more. So we could give so many examples, right? We could give at least 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 examples for a modern society. You know, the idea of chemical fertilizers and pesticides, which were supposed to create a green revolution and feed the planet. And that was how they were propounded when I was young. And we really believe that. I mean, we really seriously believe that. And the result is that everybody's become sicker. Right? So this is the decision in the mode of ignorance. Anytime we make a decision and we get the opposite of what we intended, we can understand that that decision was made in the mode of ignorance. Then in the mode of passion, you're just confused because you can see partially. Sometimes you get something right, sometimes you don't get something right. So if our life is that kind of thing, if some of our decisions are very good and some of them are fair and some of them are poor, we're probably in the mode of passion. In the mode of goodness, you see everything clearly. Krishna says you see what is binding, what is liberating, what is to be feared, what is not to be feared. You have a clear understanding. So if people could just bring their mind to the mode of goodness, their other problems, so speaking on the material level, their other problems would basically be solved. And when human society is basically in goodness and sattva-guna, the earth is very prosperous. People don't even need to do agriculture. The earth just provides what everybody needs. Because everybody's acting properly. Everyone is acting in harmony. And people today who talk about, you know, being in balance, being in harmony with the earth, being in harmony with other living entities, being in harmony with the universe, they're talking about this achievement of the mode of goodness. And the primary way of achieving the mode of goodness is for the mind to become steady. As soon as the consciousness becomes steady and unwavering, then one goes to this mode of goodness. Now, we in the Hare Krishna movement are not interested in the mode of goodness for the sake of the mode of goodness. We're interested in the mode of goodness as a platform for spirituality. And Krishna nicely explains also in the Bhagavad Gita that happiness in the three modes, happiness in the mode of ignorance is not happiness at all. You know, it's just, I'm really bad. And happiness in the mode of passion, there's a little bit of sense happiness that one has earned through pious activities. Happiness in the mode of goodness, Krishna says, awakens one to self-realization. Because when the mind is steady and the mind is in sattva and can see clearly, one of the items that will be seen clearly is the self. One will be able, from that platform of mental clarity, to see the self and God. At least there's a possibility of it. At least you're open to the possibility. The mode of passion, the mode of ignorance, you can't see God. And even if God is standing before you, you can't see him. Which is what we see happens with the demons in the Bhagavatam, that Krishna is standing right in front of them, and they still don't, basically, they don't see him. You understand? They just don't see him. Just like the governor of the state, I don't know who it is, and so if that person walked in the room, I wouldn't see that person for what the person is, you follow. I'd see them, but I wouldn't really see them. You know, I don't know the qualifications of each of you, for example. So perhaps somebody in this room right now is a very, very qualified, an expert person in some field. But I don't know that. I don't have the vision to understand that. So the demons, they see God, even Duryodhana saw the universal form of the Lord, and still he couldn't understand, I'm dealing with Krishna. So when the mind is in the mode of goodness, then naturally one has the ability to see the Lord in the heart and to see the soul. So this is why we're interested in goodness. So how do we get the mind to be stable? Or we should say even beyond that, we're particularly interested in the mode of goodness, not so much so that God and the soul is revealed, but so that we can achieve the highest perfection of life, which is to absorb our mind in the personality of Godhead. Now, we don't want to absorb our mind in the personality of Godhead, hopefully, anyway, so we can get clarity, and so just so we can get liberation from the material entanglement. But we want to absorb ourselves in the personality of Godhead, because either we already love him, or we would like to. So in this world, for example, when someone already loves someone else, they naturally absorb their mind in that person who they love, correct? It's a very natural thing if love has already existed. If you're trying to love something, then you work at absorbing your mind in it. Okay? So let's say you have some proclivity for art, you have some proclivity for music. You have, you know, some budding interest in it. So then you go to a music school or an art school, and you try to fix your mind on that thing in order to really develop your love for it. Does that make sense to everybody? Yes? If there's something that you want to love, you already have some spark or the desire to love it, but the love is not fully manifest, then you absorb your mind in that thing. So that's the difference between practiced bhakti and perfected bhakti. So the devotee naturally wants to fix their mind on Krishna if they already love Krishna, or if they have some inclination to love Krishna and they want it to grow. The way to grow any kind of love is to absorb yourself in that person or that thing. Yes? Am I correct? Yeah. Krishna talks about this in Bhagavad Gita 2:62 and 63. If you want to get really attached to something, you absorb your mind. If we want to accomplish anything in this world, we need to absorb our mind in that thing that we want to accomplish. Isn't that a fact? Right? If you want to write a paper for school, you have to absorb your mind in that paper. If your mind is jumping around, what did my friend post on social media? You know, what's for lunch today? Oh, what am I going to do about my taxes? I mean, if your mind's jumping all over the place, you can't even get your paper. So this is the idea of fixing the mind. So how does one fix the mind? Well, as already mentioned in previous verses, one wants to live a life in general in the mode of goodness. So here's talking about pranayama, but before pranayama in the Astanga Yoga system, you have to do yama niyama. The first step is yama niyama. So it's in the modern day, people are teaching meditation and pranayama directly. They're not engaging people in yama and niyama first. So they're saying, you know, you can eat meat, you can have illicit sex, you can spend all your time playing video games, and then you sit down for 15 minutes a day and do pranayama and become mindful. I mean, meditation is becoming a big, big thing in the world today. It's such a big thing. I'm on my Google Calendar. They've now added a feature where you can set goals for yourself. And Google will automatically put it into your calendar. It's a kind of neat feature. So it gives you like five different categories. One of them is exercise. And they give you options you can pick from or you can create your own. One of the top four options is yoga. Then they have another category of self-improvement. One of the top four options there is meditation. That's really interesting. So the idea of yoga and meditation has become mainstream. Now, that was not true when I was a child. So, you know, if you say to somebody, I meditate every day, they'll say, wow, that is really good. I wish I could do that. people understand it's a good thing. But they're not learning this yama niyam, so that it becomes very difficult and frustrating for them. As Prabhupada said, that it's very difficult in this age to teach this kind of Ashtanga yoga. One of the main reasons it's difficult, and I was reading about this in one of the most popular books on Ashtanga yoga, or just simple meditation, is that there's not much joy in it in the beginning. That we tend not to do something if it's not giving us, as Prabhupada explains in the preface to the Nectar of the Ocean, if it's not giving us some kind of rasa. What's driving us, Prabhupada says, in all of our activities is the rasa, or the taste we get from the thing. But if you're just doing this breathing, you're breathing out, holding it, breathing in, holding it. I mean, how much rasa is there in that? And until your mind becomes steady, which may take years, and for some of these expert meditators who really dedicate themselves to this, you know, 1 hour, 2 hours a day, like we do with our sadhana, it takes them years before they experience the happiness of the mode of goodness. So it's very hard to get people to do it. Right? So then they have to have all these techniques, you know, you get together with other people and do it that way, and that way you're motivated, and you sign up for a class, and you feel obligated, and things like that. And this one book I was like, thinking about how to present Krishna conscious meditation to the world was saying, okay, how can you try to upload joy from the beginning into your impersonalistic or voidist meditation practices? And, you know, not very many people are going to be able to do it. It's going to be the kind of thing that a lot of people try and a lot of people talk about, but not a lot of people will achieve success in it, which is basically what it is. People talk about it, you should be mindful, you should meditate, you know, it's like become a buzzword, it's become a thing, and a lot of people will make some effort, but very, very few people will persist in it. It becomes like one of the latest diet fads sort of thing. You know, the people try it for a while and then say it's too hard. You know, and if you really get into the science of making the mind and the mode of goodness by the Ashtanga yoga, it's a very complicated and subtle system, which is being hinted at here in talking about the Ida and the Pingala, and basically then you're dealing with the Shushumna. There's a whole science of mystic yoga. And it's not an easy science to do at all. I mean, also it has some side effects. So I read an article in the New York Times some time ago, last 6 months, that people should be talking about the dark side of contemplative practice. That you know, meditation in some ordinary way is being put forward as an aid for people, but there's a dark side. So do you have any idea what the dark side or the downside of people doing just pranayama and asana and so forth is?
This guy that produces ashes from his hand?
Okay, it can produce powers. And indeed it can produce powers. And what's the problem with, in fact, it will produce powers if you get into it deeply, you know? What's the downside of that? You get attached to those powers, you get diverted from the purpose of what you're doing, and you can get then pulled back down into the mode of passion. Because you get into this, you know, instead of wanting to do grossly in the mode of passion, you want to do subtly. And then eventually, yogis who get into that point lose their standing in the mode of goodness. And they're falling from, what's the other dark side of getting into just trying to become in the mode of goodness through this?
Trying to become God.
Yes, to try to become God. So, that often that's the aim of these processes, or you try to become nothing. You know, the conclusion of one of the books that I looked at is, you know, once you become the observer, which Krishna talks a lot about, being the observer, he said, then you realize there's no observer. And you become nothing. And I thought, that's really attractive, isn't it? Why do I become nothing? Yeah, some people, you know, what would you like your son to be when he grows up? A big nothing. Who was attracted to that? I guess if you're in a lot of pain, if you're in a lot of pain, then you think, I'd rather be nothing than be in pain. But if you're not in a lot of pain, the idea of becoming nothing isn't particularly attractive. What's another downside or dark side of this sort of contemplative practice? What? Misuse of powers. Misuse of powers and you get into bad karma. And it's quite, what's something you're going to become aware of, which we also become aware of in our Krishna conscious meditation. What's something you become aware of when you engage in some kind of contemplative practice?
Not this body.
Hmm?
The dirt inside us.
The dirt inside you, yes. Have you all noticed this? Has everybody noticed this? If you haven't noticed this, then you're just beginning in Krishna consciousness. But as you go on in any kind of bona fide spiritual practice, one of the signs that it's a bona fide practice is you start noticing the dark things in your own heart. When you turn on the light, you turn on the light. You understand? You turn on the light, you'll not only see Krishna and yourself, you'll also see Maya. Correct? Yes? Anyone who's a manager understands this. If they go to any part of the place where they manage and they look around, they also see what's wrong. Isn't that correct? You can always tell who feels responsible for a temple by who's walking around picking up the little bits of rubbish in there. The guests, they just walk through, they don't see it. But the leaders, they say, oh, this has got to be fixed, this has got to be fixed, this has got to be fixed, this has got to be fixed. So when you turn on the light, you see Krishna and Maya side by side. Asambhuti. Asambhuti, asambhuti. As it says in the Ishopanishad, you have to do that. This is one of the hallmarks of Sahajism, is they don't want to see that stuff. They don't want to deal with that stuff. They just want to go for the nectar. They don't want to actually deal with the attachments. So if you're in a Krishna conscious process and you see the dirt in your heart, it's in the context of loving attachment to Krishna. It's just like if you have some friendship with another human being or some love with another human being, part of what will come out in that relationship, if it's a deep relationship, are your relationship problems. Have you all noticed this in your human relationships? Yes? If I have any kind of deep dealings with somebody, some of my own relationship faults will surface. And if I really care about that person, whether they're a parent, a sibling, a spouse, or a friend, it doesn't really matter what the relationship is. If I really care about my relationship with that person, I will want to deal with my relationship faults in order to have a better relationship. So in bhakti, when we see the dirt in the heart, it's in the context of a loving relationship. It's being shown to us by our best friend in order to have a better relationship. When one sees this just in some Astanga yoga system, it's not in that context. And it can become very overwhelming. And there are people who, when they see this dirt in the heart through a contemplative process, you can get psychological problems. One of my devotee friends who's a natural mystic yogi, who's basically born a mystic yogi, has said to me that, you know, how giving these powers to ordinary people is like giving a chainsaw to a 3-year-old. You're unleashing forces in the body that you don't know how to deal with. And in fact, I've met a number of people who take up these processes of Astanga Yoga and end up having severe physical and even mental diseases from unleashing forces and powers that they're not equipped to handle. I met one devotee in India, one brahmachari, who, before he joined the movement, went to one of these yogis, and this yogi used his own power to open up this gentleman's kundalini. And since then, he's had terrible stomach problems, he's been open up to subtle demoniac entities, and he had all kinds of problems because somebody artificially opened a door that he wasn't able to deal with. Do you understand? And he couldn't figure out how to close it again. He couldn't let the shakti, couldn't lock the shakti back in. So I thought it was interesting that in the New York Times they were listing these as problems. They were saying, you know, in a regular newspaper, and they were saying, you should be careful, you shouldn't think that contemplative practice is only benign. And then on top of that, it's very difficult to do. So therefore, it's not very advised to do that in and of itself as one spiritual practice. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita never advises Ashtanga Yoga separate from bhakti. We don't advise that. We don't advise Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga as separate processes in and of themselves. In fact, Srila Prabhupada says that these should never be advised at any time as separate processes in and of themselves. Krishna says, Klesha dikataristesham, avyaktashakutejasam, avyaktahi vitirajukam, dhyayetam, tenavadviravampita. So although these processes are given in the Vedas, they are given as simply handmaidens of bhakti. They are not intended to be performed independently. Independently, they're slow, they're cumbersome, they're dry, and they have all kinds of negative possibilities. If somebody wants to perform them with bhakti, even mixed, if they want to do karma vishu bhakti, or jnana vishu bhakti, or yoga vishu bhakti, that can be acceptable, although even that we don't suggest in our Hare Krishna movement. We don't suggest it in general, and we certainly don't suggest it at the present time. Of course, in bhakti, we do use aspects of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana yoga, but they don't cover our bhakti. We don't feel that our bhakti is dependent on them, nor do we do them independently. Now, some people in our movement do that, but that's not what we're teaching. So we're saying karma yoga is you do pious activities, you offer the result to Krishna. In jnana yoga, you become detached by studying philosophy. And in dhyana yoga, you put the mind in the mode of goodness in a mechanical fashion. So again, we do pious activities, we offer to Krishna, we study philosophy. And we may certainly sit straight and breathe properly. It's not that we're opposed to these things in and of themselves. But our process for fixing the mind on Krishna is different. We are not in the Hare Krishna movement trying to first achieve the mode of goodness and then achieve bhakti. If this is all that you can remember from this class, this is so our process, according to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada, is not first achieve the mode of goodness and then achieve bhakti. That is not our process. If someone thinks that that's our process, they are covering bhakti with one of the other kinds of yoga. They're saying, first I have to do karma yoga, then I can do bhakti. Or first I have to do jnana yoga, then I can do bhakti. Or first I have to do dhyana or ashtanga yoga, and then I can do bhakti. I'm seeing this mood more and more in our Islam movement. People were saying, you know, before you can really do bhakti, you have to do varnashram. That's karma yoga, or at best, karma vishu. Or people saying, you know, before you can think about Krishna, you have to become detached from the world through philosophy. That's jnana yoga, or at best, jnana vishu bhakti. Or before you can meditate on Krishna, you have to learn these techniques of asana and pranayama. And once you've steadied the mind, then you can think of Krishna. I hear that less frequently, but it's there. And that is, again, either just jnana yoga or yoga vishu bhakti. Our process is different. And not only is it different, it's very natural. And it doesn't have these risks associated with it. So our process is, to whatever extent you can fix your mind right now, in whatever mode of nature you are right now, put it on Krishna. Even if you can only fix your mind for 5 seconds at a time on Krishna, or 10 seconds at a time on Krishna, and then your mind immediately jumps to something else, that's okay. Fix it on Krishna. I was just reading again this morning in the Nectar Devotion, where Prabhupada said that sadhana bhakti begins with fixing one's mind on Krishna. I find very interesting, and I didn't have the time to go into depth, that Prabhupada quoting from Bhagavad Gita 12.9 Abhyasa Yogi Yuti, or actually in 8.8 Abhyasa Yogi Yuti, in regard to Astanga Yoga. In chapter 12, Abhyasa Yoga is in regard to pure bhakti and not some mixture of Astanga Yoga. So how are we trying to fix our mind on Krishna? We're trying to fix our mind on Krishna through natural attraction. And the processes that we're engaging, again, I was just reading this morning, are not to put something artificial. Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga, and Dhyan Yoga are all artificial. This way of breathing is artificial, isn't it? Is that the way we naturally breathe? Is that the way we naturally, is that how we naturally breathe? No. So it's imposing something artificial on the body, because Krishna's designed the human bodies that if you just flick certain switches, you can put it in the order of things. But bhakti is not artificial. We are naturally attracted to attractive people and things. Yes? Isn't it?
Yes.
If we see a human being who is attractive looking, we naturally want to look at them. Am I correct?
Yes.
I was in an airport once, and there was this young woman who was just strikingly beautiful. I'm sure you're aware that most of the so-called beautiful people on this earth are really the product of cosmetics. Lighting. There aren't that many genuinely strikingly beautiful people walking around on the planet. Anyway, this was one of them. And everybody who walked past, men, women, and children, were just simply staring at this person. Now, that was many years ago. I'm sure nobody is staring at her. It was just, you couldn't help it. You just simply couldn't help looking at this person. And the person was so incredibly striking, beautiful, that you were just, wow. You didn't want to stop. You know, it was sort of embarrassing because, at least in the West, we're taught not to stare at people. And so you're trying to look at the person and not stare at them. And I ended up being at a gate right by where she was sitting. So I just observed because everybody was walking by. They were staring at me. We do this with natural phenomena. If there's a beautiful mountain, some beautiful sunrise, right? We can go to the ocean here and just sit and watch the sunrise over the ocean. Because we're naturally, we're attracted. Right? Or if somebody's very strong, very graceful, people like to watch the Olympics, to watch people who are very strong, very capable. We like to watch people, or listen to people who are very intelligent. We like to be around people who are very renowned. Wealth is also very attractive. We're attracted to it. We want to hear about it. We want to see it. We want to talk about it. Isn't that a fact? It's natural. And that's just a tiny, 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 tiny little spark. Right? Tiny, tiny, tiny little spark. That lady, or some cute little animal, or some sunset, or some, you know, wealthy business person, or some intelligent scientist, or, you know, Prabhupada says so nicely in the discussion between Jambavan and Krishna, people are interested in the brain of the scientist, but they're not interested in the brain that created the scientist. So our attraction to Krishna is actually natural, because he's the sum total of everything. All of the beauty, wealth, fame, strength. It's all in him. So if we pay any attention to him at all, we will become attracted. Naturally. Well, naturally. As soon as we divert our attention a little bit to Krishna, we will become attracted. And we will want to think about him more and more and more. And as we want to think about him more and more and more, gradually our mind becomes fixed in him. All these processes are gradual. Karma yoga, dhyan yoga, yeah, they're all that, they're all gradual. It's not that if you just start breathing like this, poof, you're going to be in the mode of goodness. It's going to take years and years of practice, maybe lifetimes of practice, before you achieve that peace and joy and equanimity of goodness, which is still egotistical, which is limited. Whereas if we gradually meditate more and more and more and more on Krishna, we're going to achieve something beyond goodness, we're going to achieve unlimited transcendental happiness, unlimited transcendental peace, which includes all the happiness, not only of goodness, but even passion and ignorance, includes all other happiness. Everything there is there. You know, if you read about what people are achieving through just ordinary dhyan, you'll see, well, we're all achieving that in Krishna consciousness without even trying for it. We're not trying for these results of the Lord of goodness. So we don't fix our mind first and then think of Krishna. By thinking of Krishna, our mind will become fixed. By thinking of Krishna, our mind will become fixed. As our mind becomes more fixed, we can think of Krishna more. As we think of Krishna more, our mind becomes fixed more. As our mind becomes fixed more, we think of Krishna more. As we think of Krishna more, our mind becomes fixed more. And during the whole time, it's Kevala Nandakanda. Because thinking of Krishna is really fun. Just meditating on your breath, my dear friends, is not very much fun. How interesting is it? Even, you know, Buddhist meditation, where they just meditate on the natural breath. You know, the expert meditator will say, now after 20 years of practice, I can fix my mind on my natural breath exclusively for 2 hours. Does that sound particularly attractive? My mind is fixed totally on my breathing process for 2 hours without wavering. Okay, you get some side effects of this limited mode of goodness, peace, and joy, and clarity by doing that. But is that particularly interesting? But to think of Krishna for 2 hours without wavering, now that would be really interesting. How Krishna's dancing on Kaliya's goods. Right? How he's fighting with Jarasandar, creating rivers of blood. That's pretty interesting. How he's dancing with billions of young girls. We were in the botanical garden yesterday. And I was, you know, just constantly, we were just thinking about Goloka Vrindavan, the forests of Goloka Vrindavan, because there's, you know, there's the South Africa section, and there's the New Zealand section, and the desert section, right? In the botanical gardens. So we were talking about how in the spiritual world there's the spring forest, and the winter forest, and the dewy forest, and the monsoon forest, and all the different flowers there. You know, and then when I got back, I was thinking how, well, okay, Krishna has his Rasa Lila in the forest. But if you're going to have a Rasa Lila with, you know, hundreds of thousands or billions of people, you'd have to have a pretty big area. If you're going to dance, it would have to be flat, right? Do they have Rasa? Because the botanical garden is very hilly. So I was thinking, you know, could you have a Rasa Lila in a hilly terrain? You know, it would have to be really flat. Usually we think of dancing, like my daughter's partner too. Dance teacher. So, you know, they're very particular about their surfaces, what they dance on. And what kind of surface are you going to dance on in a forest? What kind of dancing surface would you have in a forest? And would it be just like, you know, crust-jeweled sand, and how big of an area would it be? And so I was meditating on that. That's a fun thing to meditate on, isn't it? What's the area? What's the Ras Mandala look like? What does the ground look like? What do the forests look like? How is Krishna playing with the cowherd boys? You know, they're, Krishna, you're not very strong. I'm going to beat you up. You didn't really hold up Gauranga Hill. It was my Mangal's mantras that held up the hill. I mean, that's a fun thing to meditate on, isn't it? Krishna speaking, you know, whatever you like, you can find it in Krishna. If you like romance, if you like games, if you like chivalry, even if you like ghastly things like rivers of blood, you know, if you like scary things like the battle of Kurukshetra, if you like angry things, you know, Lord Varaha fighting with Hiranyaksha, whatever you like. It's there in Krishna's pastimes. The whole variety, much better than any, you know, modern media of Superman or whatever is going on in the world. Isn't it? So Kevalananda Kanda, thinking about Krishna, is simply joyful. Even if you just fix your mind on Krishna for a few seconds, it's joyful. So that's our process. And the way that we meditate in the Hare Krishna movement, specifically, I mean, we should be thinking about Krishna all the time. When we're at our job, when we're, you know, taking care of our children, when we're driving the car, all times. But the main, our main method that helps us think about Krishna all the time is our own meditative practice. We do have a practice of meditation in the Hare Krishna movement, which is what Prabhupada talks about in this verse. And he talks about basically three things, which are all very related to each other. He talks about meditation on Krishna's name, meditation on Krishna's form. And he also says kirtaniya siddhartha. So we have two kinds, therefore there's, I'm saying three, because we have two kinds of meditation on Krishna's name. One is in japa, and one is in kirtan. These are related to each other, but they're not exactly the same. So all three of these, japa, kirtan, and dealing with Krishna's form, we deal with Krishna's form, most of us, primarily through deity worship. Primarily through deity worship. Of course, some people are dealing with Krishna's form through art, and that's the meditation on Krishna's form. They paint pictures of Krishna. But for most of us, our meditation on Krishna's form is the deity worship, either taking care of the deities ourselves or coming to see the deities and to think about the form of the deities, to have pictures in our home and so forth. So this is our main way of meditation. So all of these three things should be done as a meditation. The purpose of them is to bring us to Savayamana Krishna Pradharanandaya, where we're thinking about Krishna's 24 hours per day. So I don't have time to go into these in depth, but so we're just going to touch on them, and I'm sure you won't feel satisfied because I'm just going to touch on them. Because each of these could be a class into and of itself, but that wasn't the main focus of this verse, so I didn't want to take that as the main focus of that. So let's look first at form, at deity worship. So when we're doing the deity worship, we should be remembering, here is Krishna. Here is Lord Nityananda. Here is Lord Chaitanya. Here is Balaram. Here is this personality that I'm dealing with. It's not, we shouldn't take it as some kind of a ritual. Prabhupada was very emphatic, and he would say, you know, if you take the deity worship as a ritual, it will become a burden, and then everything will be ruined. There's a, someday I may compile quotes about all the ways in which Prabhupada said we could ruin his time. But one of them is to take deity worship as a burden, as some job I have to do, where we become absorbed in the mechanics of it. And if we give some kind of material analogy, if you're cooking for people you like, of course you're going to become absorbed to some extent in the mechanics of it. Otherwise, you're going to cut off your finger along with the cabbage. So there has to be some absorption, or you're over-salted, or you're under-salted, or something. Of course, Krishna may still eat it, like he ate the banana peels, if you neglect to become absorbed in the mechanics. But generally, if you're cooking for someone you love, you have some absorption in the mechanics of it, but your main absorption is in the person you're cooking for. And the viewer cooks. Or if you're cleaning, you know, you have some guest coming and you're cleaning for the guest, so you have some absorption in the mechanics. How am I moving the cloth? What kind of chemicals am I using? And so forth. But your main absorption is for the person. I want to get this done before they come, right? I hope they're going to be happy with it. Whatever we're doing like that, you know, if you're working at a job, you may be absorbed in the mechanics of your job, but your main absorption is the person you're trying to please. Maybe that's your boss, maybe that's your customer, maybe it's your client. Does this make sense to everyone? Maybe it's your family, it's bringing home your paycheck, and people keep pictures of the person that they're trying to please on their desk. So when we're dressing the Lord and offering to the Lord personally, we should have some absorption in that person. I mean, how rude is it not to? You understand? How rude would it be that I'm helping you get dressed, but I'm not thinking about you? Would be really not a very nice thing. I'm making your room smell nice. I'm turning on the lights. I'm putting fresh flowers. But I'm there just like this. Then we become like a paid person. You know, you could pay somebody to come in the temple and light incense and put up flowers and clean the room, and there's just their job. And for them, there's no difference doing it in the temple or doing it as an office. They don't really care. They want to satisfy the customer just to get paid. Right? So that's not, we're not supposed to be doing deity worship like that. Oh, this is just my job. But we should actually be meditating like that. No, Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, here's a seat, please sit down. People, welcome, come, sit down, be comfortable here. Let me wash your feet, let me wash your hands. Here's something to clean your mouth. Here's some nice thing, nice taste in your mouth. Ah, you can clean your mouth again. And meditate then. Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya, they're doing the Ajman and they're cleaning out their mouth and you're watching them do this. Oh, and here's your bath. And here's your clothes. Do you like these clothes? What do you think of this outfit today? How do you like to wear this? How would you like it to be put on? Would you like this jewelry or that jewelry? Oh, well, let me put some sandalwood on your feet. You'll be comfortable as you walk around. Oh, let me give you some nice scents to have in your room. Maybe just have some stick of cheap Indian incense. But you can meditate. I do this what I do every day. I meditate that it's actually frankincense from Oman. I find it really sad that the devotees in Oman were buying oils from India. I said, don't you know this is the seat of fragrance in the world? Oh, really? I said, yeah, you should be bringing oils to India, not bringing oils from India to you. So, you know, putting out the charcoal and putting on the best. Oh, you have a nice scent. And then here's a lamp. Here's all these lamps to light up your room. And here's flowers. Maybe the only flowers that we have are, what did Vishnu Drupa say yesterday? A well-dressed gentleman without qualifications for the scentless flower offense. You know, they grow flowers now often to look pretty, but not to smell. So at least we can imagine I'm offering you gardenias and langlands and putting them everywhere. And then you're doing it for a person. Here's some nice food for you. And meditate on them eating the food. And what was his name? Raghunanda? What was his name? Mukunda's son. Raghunanda? Was that it? Raghunanda was so much into this consciousness that when he saw that the food was still on the plate, he started getting angry at the deity. He said, you have to eat, or my father's going to yell at me. And therefore, Mahaprabhu saw Mukunda. He said, who's the father? Who's the son? Are you the father, Mukunda? Or are you the son? He said, I am the son. I'm my son's son. So we should worship the deity like this every day, not become complacent. It shouldn't become a job. I'm waving the incense. And when we see the deity like that, it should be a meditation on the deity's form. Actually, one devotee I know, who's been a pujari for many years, not in this temple, but many of you actually know this person, told me how one time she had a dream where the predominating deity, Krishna deity, that he had gone into the pujari room and he was going through all the drawers and the closets and saying to her, I really like this outfit. This one I don't like so much. And I like it when you put the turban over here with this outfit. And I like it when you put these jewels on me. And he was giving her a tour in the pujari room, telling her what he liked. And then in her dream, someone else starts to enter the pujari room. So the Krishna deity left the pujari room and ran onto the altar and assumed his threefold bending form. But this is the mood, actually, of worshiping. And this would be our meditation on Krishna's form. And Prabhupada said one of the reasons that we come and see the deity is so that we can remember the form of the deity throughout the day. And we can think about everything I'm doing is for the deity. This is true in our own home. If we have the deity in our home, that we think everything I'm doing is for the deity. This is not my home. It's the home of the deity. And that way be fixed on the form of the Lord. Then in Japa, Prabhupada talks about hearing the name, being absorbed in the sound of the name. And we should note that although in this purport he mentions this twice, that Srila Prabhupada's instructions to just hear the name whenever Prabhupada gave an individual instruction, that was always a second tier. He would always say, when you chant Hare Krishna, you should feel the presence of Krishna, and immediately you remember Krishna's instructions to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, or how Krishna's playing with the cowherd boys, and if you can't do that, then just try to hear the name. So that was a consistent instruction. And that, but that should come naturally. It shouldn't be mechanical. The bhakti should not be something mechanical. It shouldn't be, I'm supposed to remember Krishna's pastimes right now. Okay. Krishna did this pastime. Krishna did that pastime. All right, Krishna, Krishna, Krishna did that. No, that's not very pleasing to Krishna. When we're dealing with a person. So it's very nice in the Bhagavatam 284 and 285. It explains that the holy name enters the heart and sits on the lotus of our loving relationship. If we want the name to sit in our consciousness, then we have to chant in the mood of a loving relationship. And our remembrance, Prabhupada will say immediately, say, as soon as you chant Hare Krishna, immediately you remember Krishna's form, Krishna's pastimes. Now we do this materially without any difficulty. As soon as I say to you, my mother, immediately a picture of my mother's form comes to my mind. Doesn't this happen to all of you? Immediately, automatically. I don't have to mechanically say, now I am going to remember my mother's form. And I also immediately remember something about her. I remember some of her qualities immediately. And I remember some of my dealings with her, my relationship with her. Isn't that true? Yes? Okay? If I say, Bill Gates, don't you get a picture of his face in your mind? And you think of something that he does and something about him. It's just natural. So we should. This should be happening to us with Krishna. Prabhupada said if it isn't, then our chanting is inattentive and our Krishna consciousness is deficient. He said, why are you reading Krishna book? What is the use of your reading Krishna book if as soon as you chant Hare Krishna, you don't remember Krishna? So this chanting is meant to fix our mind, not the way the Buddhists and the impersonalists fix our mind. The Buddhists and the impersonalists have a kind of meditation where you fix your mind on an object, like your breath, or like a candle, and they're using that object as a mechanical means for attaining the Buddha Buddhas. We do not want to use the sound of Krishna's name like that. Not that I want to fix my mind on the sound of Krishna's name, and by doing so I will fix my mind. That will work. Because if you fix your mind on a candle, that's not bhakti. And in fact, it's not, that's really, it's sort of offensive to the name, isn't it? It's almost taking the name as some kind of ritualistic activity or mechanical activity. We want to meditate on the name because we want a relationship with Krishna. It should be just like we say to another human being, hey, can I meet with you today at 9 o'clock? So we should be saying to Krishna, hey, can I meet with you today at 5 a.m.? Can we have an hour and a half meeting too? You understand? Now, kirtan is a very special kind of meditation. Kirtan is group meditation. In kirtan, everyone's meditation is augmented by everybody else's meditation. If it's done properly. So if ever you're in a kirtan where everyone in the room is really absorbed in the sound of the kirtan and the meditation on Krishna, it is an extremely, amazingly powerful experience. And Krishna manifests in that kirtan. What's nice about the kirtan is because we're all helping each other. It's explained that even a materialistic person who happens into such a kirtan may get a bhava boss. They may get a reflection of ecstasy. But again, it's a question of depth and focus and concentration. Kirtan is not a time filler. We often use kirtan in ISKCON as a time filler. And people say, oh, I'll go to the class after the kirtan because that's when it really starts. So this is one of these embarrassing stories. If you're going to tell an embarrassing story, it's usually better to embarrass yourself. Embarrassing like that. So this is one of the embarrassing or meaningless stories. So I was in New Vrindavan in Hungary for Janmashtami, and if you've never been to New Vrindavan in Hungary for a festival, do it. So especially Janmashtami, Radhashtami, Govardhan Puja, make it a point to get there for a festival. So I was there for Janmashtami, and there was one two-hour class, I think by Niranjana Swami. But the rest of the day was just kirtan. And you also use the word just. It was kirtan from whatever it was, deity greeting at 7 in the morning until midnight. The schedule said kirtan. And I thought, having been to Janmashtamis and many other places in the Hare Krishna movement, oh, there's no entertainment. So I went to Sri Ramaswamy and I said, you know, there's no drama. There's no entertainment. There's no nothing like that. I said, I have a multimedia show on Krishna's appearance. Could I show that? And he said, okay, from 10 to 11. But you cannot go 1 minute over 11 o'clock. You must end exactly 11. And I thought, well, there must be something scheduled for 11 o'clock that somehow I didn't notice on the schedule. So, you know, I ended exactly at 11 o'clock. And what happened at 11 o'clock? Kirtan. And I was thinking, why did I have to end at 11 o'clock? It was only a kirtan. So I went to Maharaj the next day, and we asked Pooja, and I said, Maharaj, why did you tell me that I had to limit the presentation to exactly 1 hour and end exactly 11 o'clock? Nothing happened after 11 o'clock. And he looked at me and he said, what happened was the main thing that happens. He said, you know, these presentations, these classes, these are secondary. He said, the main thing is kirtan. And I went, oops. And then I became aware that this is a prevalent mentality. You know, it's just kirtan going on. Or, well, people haven't arrived yet, you know, things are running a little late. Well, okay, you can just have kirtan. And I see also that many times in kirtans that many people are not in the kirtan, really. They're there with their body. I mean, some people are even checking their phones. You know, sending text messages in the kirtan. And you can tell when you're in a kirtan, when everyone is really focused, you can tell, can't you? I find we especially tend to do this when we go through a lot of trouble and money to attend the kirtan. You know, if you go to the Govardhan retreat, people have gone to a lot of trouble. They flew all the way to India. They're paying whatever it is, you know, 150 euros for the retreat. They're living in very austere conditions. You know, you have to carry a bucket of water up the stairs to take a bath. Right? You give your clothes to the dhobi, and the dhobi comes back and says, sorry, I don't have your pants. The monkeys took it off the line. But can you pay me for washing it anyway? That actually happened. So, you know, you're going through all this austerity, and so then when you're sitting in the kirtan, you're thinking, I better pay attention. Also, another story from Hungary, they collect about 150,000 euros a year from tourism. So these tourists, they come and they get a tour of the beautiful temple. And first time that I saw this, I saw these, you know, typical European tourists. Can you get a vision of the typical European tourist? Well, I'll get that picture in your mind? Okay. And there's a bunch of them, 20-25 typical European tourists. And they're in the temple room, dancing and chanting Hare Krishna. So I went to the temple president in shock. He said, Prabhu, you gotta come see what's happening in the temple room. He said, what's that? I said, the tourists are dancing and chanting Hare Krishna. He said, oh yeah, okay. I said, what do you mean, oh yeah, okay? Don't you understand? There's 25 typical European tourists chanting and dancing Hare Krishna. He says, yeah, yeah. That happens on every tour. I said, what? He said, well, you know, they paid the 5 euros. They want to get their money's worth. And I thought, gosh, why can't we be like that? So kirtan is supposed to be a meditation. It's supposed to be a group meditation. focus of the group lifts everybody up. I teach sociology of religion at Bhaktivinoda College, and one of the points that sociologists make is that organizations that demand a high commitment, not too high, if you demand too high of a commitment, then you can only get a few members. But if you don't demand a high enough commitment, then people don't get a really good experience out of it. So just like sometimes we have a meal where everybody brings a preparation, right? There are times like that. In America we call it a potluck, I don't know what you call it. But you know, everybody brings one crab. So if you have 40 people coming to a program and everybody brings a crab, then you cook one crab and you eat 40 crabs. You understand? So the more people that bring something to the program, you each person gets out far more than they put into it. If you have a temple where a lot of people come to the morning program, then everyone who comes gets a better experience. You have some temples, only 3 people come to the morning program. That's becoming more and more common. So it's the same with the kirtan. If everybody puts a whole prep into it, everybody gets a feast. It's exactly like that. If we expect that everyone's going to put their heart into the kirtan, then everybody gets a very easy and delightful experience of associating with Krishna. Or you know the old story where it's a similar kind of thing, where they're going to serve a drink and they say, everybody bring fruit juice. Right? We're going to make a punch, everybody bring fruit juice. And some people say, well, I'll just bring water. It's one of the benedictions that water got from Indra, that you can be added to other liquids, and you think the liquid has increased, where it's actually just water. So if a whole bunch of people bring water, then it's no juice anymore. Right? If the majority of people coming to the kirtan are just contributing water, and Lord Chaitanya didn't like it if even one person was doing that. The kirtans and tripas, I'm done. And if there was one person who wasn't absorbed in the ecstasy, he would notice. And there was what Tribas's mother-in-law was hiding in a pot one time. That's a very big pot. Hide in a pot. And Mahaprabhu said, I didn't feel any ecstasy today. What was the problem? So kirtan is a group meditation experience. And what's wonderful about the kirtan is that it's also involving music and dance. So even on the mundane platform, what do people do when they want to have a good time? They have music and dance. So what is the process of meditation that we've been given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, where you take the epitome of material fun, singing, dancing, and eating, and you turn it into a meditation that brings you to ultimate transcendence that includes the mode. That this fixation of the mind that people in these other processes are working decades to achieve in some dry way becomes automatic. Prabhupada said, at least in the kirtan, you forget about sexual desires, you forget about money, you forget about, you know, all the anxieties of the world disappear, at least during the time of the kirtan. So this is our process for fixing. Our individual meditation time in japa, those of us who chant Gayatri, also Gayatri, our deity worship, and our group kirtan. And then it's not actually necessary for us to do this pranayama. It's actually not necessary. The fixation of the mind will come as it is on the mind. There's no harm. As long as one doesn't think bhakti is dependent on it, then it's not necessary. So thank you very much. Nice for all of you to come on this. It's a holiday today, right?
Yes.
So I thought you would mind, since it was a holiday, that I went till 9, right? Was I right?
Yes.
Yep.
I thought people in our convenience hurry to go off to work and to school. So any questions or comments? Yes.
You were mentioning that one should perform daily worship in a meditative mode.
Yes.
Meditating a lot while
yes.
performing the worship.
Yes.
I find it hard to meditate because of time constraints, because the worship has to end by a certain time. And there's a lot to do. So to do it basically is a fine part of the meditation. So in that circumstance, how to meditate on Krishna.
That's an interesting point. So you're saying that because deity worship has to be done at a certain time, there's a lot to do, you find it harder to meditate. I would agree with you that when one does deity worship without worrying about the time, that meditation can be easier. I definitely agree with you. In my experience, having the time constraint can make it harder because you think, well, I don't have time to think about what I'm doing. What does Krishna say to Arjuna? When Arjuna talks about chanchala himanam Krishna, which is, of course, related to this achanchala, what does Krishna tell Arjuna? Yes, it is difficult, but it is possible by suitable practice, and detachment. Detachment is be detached from when it doesn't work. That's what you mean by detachment. And practice. There are mantras that we're supposed to chant before beginning deity worship. We chant mantras on meditating on how we're not this body, yes?
Yeah.
And we should chant mantras, I don't know exactly what the process is called here, but we're supposed to chant mantras meditating on the person whom we worship, yes? And we're supposed to be meditating on them in their abode. Yes? Am I correct?
Yeah.
And the purpose of that is to get us to that place. So we start the worship in that place. Now, with practice, you'll find that the time is not the issue. Although I would agree with you that when you don't have those time constraints, it's easier. I definitely agree with you. But it can be done. You can also think about who you're serving, even if it's rush. Even if there's a lot to do. And if you want to know how to do that, think about some human being you have. You know, can you care about and think about the person you're serving even if you're in a hurry? Is that possible? We don't want to go into a hurry mode. You know, you switch the, I'm now in my hurry mode, where I just focus on getting the job done and I forget about all the people that I'm doing it with. Yes, we all know that mode. Who cares if you're offended? I'm just trying to get my job done for you. I don't care if I'm being considerate of you. I don't care if I'm thinking of you. I'm in a hurry to get this job done for you. And we don't want to go into that kind of a mode. I mean, you can always say to Krishna, Krishna, I don't have a lot of time here. Hey, Lord Nityananda, I'm really in a rush. Help me, forgive you. I'm doing this, okay? Look, I'm sorry if I lose my focus sometimes, but hey, I only got another 5 minutes, right? Help me out here. Be personal. That's what I'd say to another human, right? What I'd say to another human is, hey, you know, look, I'm not trying to be rude, but we've got to catch a plane. We've got only 5 minutes. Can you just help me get this stuff done, okay? I still want to be personal. You understand? Which one of my God sisters told this story? I think she put it in writing. I don't want to say, because I can't remember which one it was. It was one or two people. How she was dressing Radharani, and all of a sudden she looked up at Radharani's face, and there was Radharani. And she thought, oh, no, all right. I better just focus on the dressing. It's really the Lord. He's actually there. So meditate that He's actually there. Yes.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Mataji, for your enlightening class. My question is, what is your most favorite pastime of Krishna consciousness, your personal?
Well, that's a very personal question. Actually, I don't have just one. I have many. I like the pastime of Lord Chaitanya when Jagannanda brings back the pilu fruits from Vrindavan. And some of the devotees didn't know how to eat them properly, and Lord Chaitanya was laughing. I like the pastime of Mahaprabhu when he goes to Vrindavan and all the forest animals are licking him and embracing him.
Just asking about your personal memory.
Oh, my personal memory?
Yeah, like your own
personal
your own experience.
Yeah. Of what, when I was back in the Loka Vrindavan?
Your own experience of that Vishnu consciousness story or any story?
I just told you. What exactly do you want?
No, some that is, I'm not asking that your Lord Pastor and that Mahaprabhu. I'm asking your
my personal pastimes with Krishna?
He's called pastimes.
You want to know my favorite thing that's happened to me since I joined the Hare Krishna movement?
That's
really personal. I don't know if I'm going to do that on camera. That's a little much. I can just tell you, I'm not going to tell you favorites, okay? I remember eating a sandesh when I first stayed in the temple before I had committed to join the movement, and I was staying for a couple of weeks, and I ate a sandesh and I meditated on it all day long, and I thought, what was that? And another time with prasadam, it was my first Govardhan Puja celebration in Chicago, and I had a galavra. It wasn't the first time I had a galavra, and I was again like, whoa. When I was at the Chicago airport distributing books, and it wasn't a regular time that we were going, we were out on Harina on a Saturday. We never went to the airport on a Saturday night, and because it was too slow, there was nobody there. And Mahamuni Prabhu said, who wants to go to the airport and do books? It was late, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Nobody wanted to go. The airport was empty. But I'm the kind of person that if you want me to do something, challenge me. Who wants to go? Am I the only one who wants to go? I bet I could do more books than anybody. So I said, I'll go. And I was never big on books. I was more moderate distributor. So we're on the bus going to the airport, and he's just saying the whole time how many books he distributes. Distributes, and I'm going, I'm going to beat it. And I only saw a person every 15 minutes, and every single person took a book and gave a huge donation. And I didn't say anything to them on my own. The words just came out of my mouth. I didn't even know what I was saying. Every person I saw stopped, and just words came out of my mouth that weren't mine. And the person took a whole bunch of books and gave me a whole lot of money. And I beat my own money. But I was just empowered the whole time. I wasn't doing it on my own. That was a really amazing experience. Krishna just empowered me. Another very early experience was when I read Lord Chaitanya's 5 features. And there it has the Mayavadi arguments and the Gaudiya counter arguments. I was very new in Krishna consciousness. This one Indian gentleman came to the Sunday feast. And it was like he had studied the same book. And he kept giving me all the Mayavadi arguments. And I just countered with Prabhupada's arguments. And he looked at me and he said, you're the most intelligent person I've ever met. And I said, that's all Srila Prabhupada. That was a pretty amazing experience. So those are some of my amazing, those are all early in Hare Krishna movement experiences. We'd be here a long time if I went from there to here. Told you all of the amazing experiences I've had with Krishna and Hare Krishna. I had an amazing experience yesterday at the Botanical Gardens. How do you know? Talking with Achintarupa about the seasonal forests of Vrindavan. That was an amazing experience. We were talking about how we can't wait to go to Goloka and have Vrindadevi show us around all the forests. That's up there with one of my favorite experiences. In fact, one of my favorite experiences of Krishna consciousness is happening right now. Much to tell me without fun. My favorite experiences in Krishna consciousness, where I feel most connected with Krishna, is when we're talking with other devotees about Krishna. I personally find very little they can hear. Yes?
Hare Krishna, Navadevi. When you were saying about making the feast, I was thinking of Raghava Pandit and Mahaprabhu. And Rukmini Devi, how nice he is. Shady Krishna.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. Anybody else? Yes.
Mataji, when usually people think of improving their sadhana, and when we discuss, and some people usually say, forget about becoming a devotee, let's first become a human being. I've heard this from many people.
That's Yam Niyam. So basically what they're saying is work on Yam Niyam first. The problem is, if you do that, what system of yoga are you practicing? What system of yoga are you practicing? If you say, forget about Krishna, let's first become human beings, what system of yoga are you practicing? One of two. Either you're doing karma yoga, you're probably doing karma yoga, or you might be doing dhyan yoga and doing yam niyam first. As soon as you say that, you just pop yourself right out of bhakti. You're no longer in pure bhakti. You're jumping to another yoga system, or you're mixing your yogas.
So we
become a human being by meditating on Krishna.
So all the qualities that a human should have, like discipline and...
More than a human. We're trying to become a heck of a lot more than a human. I'm not satisfied with just being human. All the good qualities of the demigods, we're not even satisfied with that. We want the qualities of the Goswamis. And we want the qualities of the soul. We want the qualities of part and parcel of Krishna. Human qualities, that's just Rajagun. Humans are Rajagun. Demigod qualities is a Satyagun. We want divine qualities. The only way divine qualities are going to manifest is if we wake up to who we are. And the only way we can wake up to who we are is by getting attached to Krishna. As you get attached to Krishna, naturally the divine qualities manifest. Should we make any effort to cultivate the divine qualities as part of our bhakti? Of course. Just like when you go to the shop, you read the labels on the containers. You don't say, well, I'm in bhakti, I can just shop blindfolded. So we make some effort to cultivate humility and cleanliness, but to please Krishna as part of our pleasing Krishna, not separately, and not first. Not first I'm going to become clean, and first I'm going to become humble, and then I'll think about Krishna. But because I'm thinking about Krishna, I want to clean his place. Because I'm thinking of Krishna, I don't want to be a proud, arrogant jerk around Krishna. He won't like it. He'll say, get out of here, you proud, arrogant asshole. You follow? I want to be responsible because Krishna cares. Otherwise, we're doing something else. Or it could even be Gyan Yoga. You know, I want to develop good qualities so I'll be liberated. So immediately, this is a danger. That this is what happens in all religions of the world. Very, very quickly, it starts getting mixed up. Starts going down. It's a tendency. Yadayadayi dhamashyat nanayavati archa. Vijanana dhamashyat dhamashyat. It starts going to adharma. So it'll go from bhakti to karma yoga, pretty soon it's just karma. Yes?
So it starts from prema and then it ends up in vidha prema.
Yes! What is the Anushraddha that we have? The Anushraddha is some taste. Rupa Goswami says the beginning of bhakti, it's a taste. It's an attraction. you know, I love it in Madhurya Kadambini where he has this talk about, you know, self-consciousness and Krishna consciousness. Yes, I put it into a chart how the different stages of bhakti, there's different degrees of self-consciousness and Krishna consciousness. And as we progress, self-consciousness goes down as Krishna consciousness goes up. So even at that Anushtrada, there's a tiny little trace of prema. And really, all we're doing is taking that little bit of prema and increasing it and increasing it and fanning it and fanning it. And as we do that, you can say it's going through stages of Shraddha and Sadhusanga and Bhajan Kriya. But that's the whole thing. That's it. There is nothing else. That is our process. We can use karmic jnana and yoga to support it, but we have to make sure they don't cover it or mix with it. And it's a danger we have to be aware of when people start saying, well, you know, first let's get together our karma. First let's study philosophy. First let's learn how to sit and breathe. Then we'll think of Krishna. Whoops! Just bumped out of Uttam Bhakti. It will still work, but it will take a lot longer and it will be much drier and more difficult. You'll increase the struggle and the dryness and the unsteady phase of bhakti. Why would you want to do that? You want to decrease that stage. You want to decrease the unsteady, hard struggle with determination stage. You want to make that hard struggle with determination, unsteady stage, go by as quickly as possible. And mixing other yogas with it is going to make it... Krishna says, Kleshom, he says, you're going to make it harder. So you don't have to believe me, you can believe him. He says, Kleshom, it's difficult. It'll work eventually. Yes, it will work eventually. It may take many lives, but it will work eventually. But, you know, Prabhupada says, why take the stairs if you can take the elevator? I mean, he wasn't talking about fitness. Yes?
Mataji, in Bhagavatam it says, Yasya Sivakti, Sarvabhani Samasati Suraha, the translation Prabhupada says, as demigods, the qualities of demigods. Now we know that demigods can be in the mode of goodness. So why
they generally are.
Generally are. So why does Bhagavatam say that when you engage in bhakti, develop the divine qualities of demigods when we know that they...
You will. Yes, you will. You'll develop all the good qualities of the mode of goodness. Just like if you have $100, you have $1. So, if you develop the divine... it's not really developing. If you awaken the divine qualities of the soul, then naturally the qualities of goodness are included. Naturally the qualities of a good human being and passion are included. Everything.
So does that tie back with your argument that when we engage in bhakti, naturally the...
Correct. Yeah. That doesn't mean we make no endeavor for them whatsoever, but that endeavor should be part of our bhakti. Okay, well, let's take a mundane example and then I should stop because I'm sure some of you are very hungry. So I read a story a while ago of, it was in a Muslim country, where a man divorced his wife an hour after the wedding. And the reason he divorced her is when they went to their room after the wedding ceremony, she was on her phone texting all of her friends pictures of the wedding. And he said, this is the time for us to be together. We just got married. She says, but I want to share with all my friends the pictures of the cake and the ceremony and my clothes. And he said, is that more important than being with me, your husband? And she said, yes, and he immediately divorced her. When you have a relationship with another person, whether that person is in any of the rasas, whether they're your servant, your master, your friend, your parent, your sibling, your spouse, whatever that person may be, if you want to have a nice relationship with that person, you need to work on your qualities. Is that correct? Is it possible to have a nice relationship with another human being, or even with an animal, without putting some attention to your own behavior? Is that possible? It's not possible, right? You have to. You have to put, oh, okay, I'm going to be considerate. I'm going to be humble. If you're never humble with another person, you can't have a good relationship. It's impossible. But is your focus to be able to just say, look what a nice relationship I have? Or is your focus actually love for the other person? That woman was focused on being married. You follow? Her focus was on being married rather than the husband. She wanted to look beautiful to be married. Rather than to look beautiful to please her husband. So why do we want to develop good qualities? We want to develop good qualities just so I am in a relationship with the divine in ecstasy. Or do we want to develop good qualities so Krishna will say, wow, thank you. Thank you for doing that for me. So all of our development of good qualities, even if we put some attention to it, okay, I better put some attention to my cleanliness, I better put some attention to my humility, right? I better put some attention to how I'm dealing with lust and anger and greed. We're doing that so Krishna will say, thank you so much. Again, just like in our human relationship, where somebody will say, you know, thank you for just agreeing with me and not arguing about it this time, I really appreciate it. We're doing it for that. Not so we can post a picture on social media of what a nice relationship. Here's me with Krishna. See how Krishna conscious I am. Is that right? Is that clear? It should be part of our bhakti. It shouldn't cover our bhakti. It shouldn't be separate from bhakti. It should be part of our bhakti. I just want to take care of my spouse, my kids, my friends, whatever. So Krishna will be happy. It's actually very simple. It's actually, it's extremely, extremely, extremely simple. We become attached to Krishna and we do everything to please him. That's it. All the details are just for that purpose. And then everything is taken care of because of that. So thank you very much. I hope you didn't mind having a long class on holiday. And I'll be leaving tomorrow, so thank you very much for your hospitality. Hare Krishna. Shri Prabhupada Kita.